So this call's being recorded now, and we're on oral history number 3 with Mike DeRoche from Beechey, Saskatchewan. He went to Rossignol School at Île à la Crosse. I believe, if I'm right, Mike, that it was a day school, provincial day school, by the time you were going there. Let's start by going back to those days.
No, it wasn't a day school. Well, I guess it was a day school for the community members. But for us, it was a boarding school, like a residential school.
And
for us, that lived across the lake, and there were students there from all over the west side.
What years did you go there, Mike?
I believe from 1961 to 1969.
Okay, so 4 years.
For 61 to 69 is 9 years.
Oh, sorry. Yes, your math is better than mine. why don't you describe for us what a day in the life of a child going to that school was like?
Well, the school was good. I mean, you learned your ABCs like everybody else. It was in English by the time we went.
Mm-hmm.
When my parents would have gone, it was in French.
Mm-hmm.
And then when my aunties started going there, they started in English. That would have been probably in the late 50s.
Okay.
It converted to English.
Right, right. Because it was the Oblates, the French Oblates that were there, wasn't it?
The Roman Catholic Church was the one who ran the school. There were the Oblates priests and the Grey Nuns.
Okay.
And
right.
They basically ran the school until probably the province took over the curriculum aspect of things and, you know, Sask education.
Yeah.
But,
by the time you were going there, were all the teachers and staff still clergy?
No, just some of the teachers were nuns.
Uh-huh.
And the rest were your regular teacher, married or single.
Right, right.
From down south, most of them. We didn't have teachers yet from our hometown.
Okay, right. And so walk me through a day in the life of a child going to that school.
Well, it's a typical school. You have your usual bullying in your classes. I was bullied quite a bit because I was skinny and not your physical specimen.
Uh-huh.
We didn't have a gymnasium, so all our activities were outside when it came to phys ed.
Mm-hmm.
So your phys ed was, we never had basketball, so none of us knew what basketball was until we went down south. We played a lot of soccer, lots of hockey, things
mm-hmm.
like that. I wasn't much of a hockey player, though, because of my size and because I had glasses.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as I go skating, I'd fog up. Well, then you can't see anything. So,
right.
I was a write-off when it came to hockey. But we played lots of rubber ball and softball, fastball, you know.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that was pretty good. And then we had your usual school track meets.
Okay.
But your basic everyday learning, we had a shop. There was actually a home ec room, too.
Okay.
Unfortunately, they don't have those these days, and they should. I think
yeah.
it helped a lot of young ladies learn how to sew,
mm-hmm.
learn how to cook.
Uh-huh.
We learn how to play with wood. We actually mm-hmm. helped our school teacher, Sam Oleski, build a speedboat made out of wood.
Uh-huh.
We built a nice, you know, those ice sailboats that run on skis?
Yeah.
We helped him build one of those. But
and what did he use it for?
When the lake froze over, he went on a ski sailing, but it didn't last long. I think it got demolished in Big Island when it ran aground. He would have had to have bailed out, I think. I don't remember the exact story. but it didn't last long. We also built boomerangs, which got outlawed in the community because of all the broken windows. So, yeah, we learned a lot of stuff in school, actually. The school part was good.
Yeah.
I loved school.
Yeah.
It was the residential school part that was a nightmare, so that's
right.
The difference. The school
right.
was good. The residential school part was not, to a degree.
What proportion of your day would you say you spent learning?
Well, your typical classroom, 9 to 3:30.
Uh-huh.
And then the rest of the time we had our free time. Either we were probably on the ice skating. Every time we were out of the school, we'd be in the skating rink. There was nothing else to do in the winter but skate, so that's what we did. Dig tunnels in the snowbanks and whatever had to be done.
Mm-hmm. And so you talked about how you liked woodworking, and quite a few things that you've told us that you liked were some of your interests. What were some of your interests outside of school?
Well, I was at home. I'd be out hunting, snaring rabbits, helping Dad pull a net out of the lake. You know, I'm setting a net, an old net along the beach, and I'd go catch ptarmigan with a net in the wintertime to eat. So, no, most of my time out of school was back home across, and we were always busy doing stuff.
Mm-hmm. And how did you feel when you had to go back to school?
Well, and sometimes in the winter we liked it because they had running water and we didn't have to use the bathroom outside. So as little kids, we enjoyed that part, you know.
Yeah.
You had running water and stuff. You had a bathroom. I don't know. There was fun things and then there was the bad stuff. So I don't know.
Well, let's talk about the bad stuff. You know, when you said you were bullied, what did that entail?
Well, you'd get beat up. If you try to stand your ground, you'd get pushed and beat up. And basically, that's your typical bullying in any age level, from when you're little kids to bigger kids, you know.
And what about the supervision?
There was really, you policed your own. There was no... Even if you tried to deal with it, say you went to the master in the residential school, you were just told you were nothing but a weakling and couldn't handle yourself or whatever. It was no good. So it made no sense.
Did you ever try to...
You're just better off to take a bat and bust his leg. So,
right.
I never had to do that, but, you know.
Did you ever tell your parents?
No. It wouldn't be no good anyway. It's the same thing. And then I wouldn't want my dad to go into a fight with somebody either. So, because he would, right?
Yeah.
He would have defended me. So, no, you didn't say none of that stuff at home. You had to man up.
You had to what?
Man up and, you know, and tough it out without having to tell your parents, because I mean, if dad heard some of that stuff happen, I mean, he would go there and take a bat on somebody or whatever, a stick. So no, you wouldn't want your dad to get in trouble.
Right. And what about in terms of the physical and sexual abuse that you were experiencing and that you told us about in the previous recordings?
We had older cousins that would protect us when it came to bullying and stuff like that.
Okay.
But when it came to sex abuse, it was pretty rampant in the residence amongst the boys. Everybody, I don't know, there was a lot of kids involved in so many different ways. It was always, all that stuff happened in the dark. You didn't see nothing.
Yeah. In secret?
Well, yeah. I mean, like I said earlier, I mean, it was almost as if we were little Greek boys practicing to become men.
Yeah.
you know, in many ways. And then there were threats, you couldn't talk. And but I'm sure the nuns and stuff that did all your laundry knew something wasn't right, because your clothes would be soiled, your underwear and stuff would
Right.
be soiled. Because, I mean, this happened every day, every night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you became the abused, and then you became the abuser. And what ended up with us getting kicked out of school, and I mean, it was my fault. I got three of my cousins involved. They wouldn't have gotten kicked out of school. It was my fault I did that.
Right.
But it was the abuse involving the little kids by the master that we didn't like. I mean, there was some abuse amongst us in our age group, but it didn't involve little, you know, 7, 8-year-old kids.
Yeah, like for you, that was just crossing a line.
Well, for a supervisor, especially in clergy, and we wanted to do something about it, and we ended up getting kicked out, and we were never believed. I mean, the clergy ruled back in the day, and nobody ever believed us. So I got a good licking for, you know, for my grandparents and then my parents. And so, I mean, that's... But I'm the one who actually started that whole mess and paid for it, probably to this day.
Really, eh?
Yes.
What do you...
Well, it wasn't a good experience, and then there's a stigma. Like, you were a troublemaker, and you did this,
yeah,
and got kicked out of school. But, I mean, with all good intentions was what happened. I mean, we didn't go beat people up. I mean, we weren't bullies.
Yeah.
A lot of the abuse was involved with us kids that were non-sports. I mean, the good little hockey players and stuff, they were left alone.
Okay.
So there was kind of an unwritten rule. You left, you know, the young athletes alone and stuff. So that's kind of an unwritten rule I kind of to observe, I guess, today. Because some of my cousins that were good hockey players never experienced what I went through.
Wow. And they told you that you guys talked about that later in your life?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, of course.
And how do, when you do talk to others that you went to that school with about the fact that a place like your school was not included in the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement, how do you feel about that? What do you say about that?
Well, I think it's your typical government trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the church was involved, the province was involved, and the federal government was involved, and then they should just cut the pie three ways and deal with it instead of saying, well, they have to look at it. They've been bouncing us back and forth like political footballs for the last probably 30 years, 20 years for sure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, half of us have died. I guess they're waiting for most of us to die, and then they'll say, okay, we'll give you a settlement.
Mm-hmm.
But for me personally, they need to pay more than they did to the other residential schools just from the fact of how they treated us. I don't expect to get the same as the other ones. I expect more.
Because okay.
We've been neglected, mistreated. But yet, the province looked after the school, so they have some fiduciary duty to look after the best interests of Duke's kids.
Mm-hmm.
The church is the same thing. The federal government, they were involved in their own different ways. I mean, my mom had to turn over my family allowance, which was a measly little $8 then, but
mm-hmm.
she had to turn that over to the mission, to the church, for me to go to school.
Uh-huh.
So my mom's little $8, which she would buy flour and all her necessary groceries, she had to turn that to the mission 10 months of the year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where we argue that's where the federal government comes in.
Yeah.
But then they still deny, well, we didn't make them do that. Well, it don't matter. I mean, it's just, I don't know, it's frustrating.
Yeah. Yeah. And just digging a little deeper into your experiences there, how are things like medical services or the food that you ate or the conditions of the building that you lived in? What, describe those things for me a little bit.
Well, we always had our own hospital. Alacross has had a hospital for years and years. So we've always had a hospital there, nurses, doctors. Our building where we initially started from in Alacross burned down. I forget how old I was. But I was watching, the theater used to be in the basement of the boys' residence.
Mm-hmm.
The middle floor was the main play area, and then the upstairs were the dorms and stuff.
Right.
But the basement area, there was a big wood furnace down there, those big wooden furnaces with the 3-foot logs, you know, like I was talking about earlier that my family contracted with.
Yes.
Anyway, I was watching the Hunchback of Notre Dame, and then somebody hollered fire, and we all were able to escape. Nobody died. Kids were upstairs sleeping. They all got out. And we all got hauled off to the basement of the hospital, and we could see the fire from there.
Wow.
The whole building burned down. And so we had no school for, I forget, about 6 weeks.
Uh-huh.
We all went home, spent time at home, because we had no place to stay.
Uh-huh.
In the meantime, they converted an old school that they used to have. They converted that into a boys' residence.
Right.
And our bunk beds were triple bunks, three high.
Right.
Just put all of us in there because it wasn't a big building.
Mm-hmm.
And then over the next summer, they built the new residential building that you see now, that picture I sent you.
Yes.
That was the new one. And that was up until last year when they ripped it down. So, but we used to go to the convent for meals.
Okay.
By and large, the meals weren't too bad. There was a few things that never tasted good, like probably a little freezer burnt, like liver, never tasted good.
Yeah.
Certain stuff. By and large, I mean, I didn't mind the porridge. They used to have three kinds of porridge, watery, medium, and thick porridge. I've got friends today who won't eat porridge, but I've always eaten porridge. Even now, I love porridge. I mean, it's healthy.
But me too.
I have friends who say, oh, I won't eat porridge no more. I ate enough when I was in residential school. Well, I don't know. I find that funny. But anyway, by and large, we had activities involved and stuff, and I mean the residence wasn't all bad. I mean, a lot of kids, there was a lot of hockey, sports. We'd go out on picnics and stuff, sporting activities, drama. We were all involved in a lot of drama type of stuff when there was festivities with the church, like during Christmas, Easter, all that.
Yeah, you always liked art and theater, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, but by and large, I mean, most of it to me was good, except the abuse and the bullying and stuff. And, you know, in some places, communities are dysfunctional. I mean, Isle of Cross has its own dysfunctional things we need to accept, and whether they like it or not. And one of them is bullying. I mean, You still see a lot of bullying in the community, even when I go home. And I'm 65 years old, and I still see that.
Right.
Yeah, it's pretty hard how people treat each other. But so what? I guess I don't live there. I live here.
Well, I guess in part it's because of how they've been treated, right?
I suppose. Yeah, I mean, colonialism, I mean, we've always had to deal with white people, you know, telling us what to do.
Yeah.
Like I said, with our school in 1976, they had a sit-in, and we took over the school.
Okay.
The school is run by the community today. It's not run by the church.
Uh-huh.
A person lost his life over that fight.
Who?
A cousin of mine.
And
I mean,
what's the story?
Well, no, they were fighting. They were at a drinking party, and they started arguing about the school and the church and whatnot, and somebody died.
Yeah.
But we did take over the school. It's locally run now. It has been since 19, the 70s. The school itself was blacklisted with the Saskatchewan Teachers Federation for a point, thinking it was a difficult place to... But now I think teachers are literally fighting over each other to go teach there. I mean, it's a very good school.
Okay.
We've got our own... a lot of our own educators too now that have gone on and finished school and became teachers.
Yeah. And that makes a difference?
Well, a big difference. The only thing is we lost our language, and so there's a big drive now to try and get Mi'kmaq back. Like, my generation is probably the last ones who actually speak fluent Cree, Mi'kmaq.
Yeah, yeah.
But there is a big drive now to get it back, and I hope it works.
Are your grandkids learning it?
Well, I'm guilty of not teaching them enough. I should be. So, you know, because, well, my children don't, because I didn't raise my kids, my twins. So that's different.
Uh-huh.
I think if I had raised them, they would have had a little bit of better chance to speak it. But I should actually try and speak to my granddaughter more in Mi'kmaq.
Mm-hmm. And so... Tell me something in Mi'kmaq. Tell me something in your language.
Well, I don't know what. I mean,
maybe tell me who your something about your children.
Well, no, not really, because what am I going to say? It's all Cree. Laptop is a table, so Tamitsuan Talashendapin with Talatab is a set in the stand. So when I'm eating, I sit on my chair and I put my plate on my table.
Right? Okay, yeah. So
anyway.
do you still speak it to anyone?
Of course. I actually broadcasted. I was a broadcaster for a while.
Okay.
So,
in the community?
Out of LaRonde, yeah, but they have a radio broadcasting system for Northern Saskatchewan.
Uh-huh.
Out of LaRonde.
Uh-huh.
So I did a stint there as a broadcaster.
Okay. And was that before or after you became a lawyer?
Before.
Okay. Before. Did you like that?
I loved it, except I got a job offer to be a CEO for the Lac La Ronge Indian Band, and so I left that job, and I regret I did, because I really enjoyed working on the radio. But again, you had to work for white people, and I really didn't like that.
Yeah.
We had a white person running the radio show, and it's supposed to be an Aboriginal radio. So,
oh.
Again, there I had problems, right?
Yeah.
I've had problems with that. Interpersonal skills. I have good interpersonal skills as human resource, but yet, on the other hand, I don't. When
yeah.
it comes to conflict resolution, I'm too passive. I have a hard time firing people. I'm too nice. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So it becomes a problem when it's supposed to be. I was director of HR. I had no problem writing a letter of dismissal to somebody that I didn't really know, because you were director of a workforce of 500 people.
Right.
And then I got into a situation where I was a CEO for LaRonde Band again, but a small reserve called Grandmother's Bay, and I just loved it there, and I loved everybody, and everybody knew me.
Uh-huh.
But there was a situation that came up, and I couldn't fire this individual because I knew her, and I knew her family and stuff, and it's a close-knit community.
Yes.
I couldn't come up to fire her. I
yeah.
couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And it
yeah.
was a downfall. You know, I really felt bad because I felt I couldn't do my job. So when my contract came up, I didn't renew it. Well, there was distance driving as well that was involved in the whole thing. But
yeah.
It was too close to people that I knew, and it
yeah.
really affected me. So I retired.
Right. But you did some trucking, didn't you?
Yes, I trucked for 10 years. Well, I still drive truck now. I help out with the farm here at home on harvest and stuff.
Uh-huh.
But I drove truck from 1981 till 1990. And it was a good living driving north to the mines, and then I hauled uranium to the States and ended up all the way down into Houston and places like that. It was a good way to see the country for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
But I still have my license. I mean, it's a good thing to fall back on.
Yeah.
It always brings me extra income, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
mm-hmm.
go drive full time, but I enjoy driving when I do in the fall during harvest. That's pretty much when I drive now. That's about it. I don't drive for a living in terms
mm-hmm.
of trucking. So.
Mm-hmm. And going back a little bit to your years after leaving school, the poster incident, you spent some years hunting and trapping and fishing, commercial fishing, and then something happened and you decided to go into law. Tell me about that time in your life.
Well, I got married when I was 36, so what happened was I wanted to get out of trucking. That was about 1990.
Uh-huh.
And I had an opportunity to go to this program called NORPAC, which is a Northern Professional Access Program. It was the first 2 years of arts and sciences with the University of Regina and the University of Saskatchewan.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend of mine, Rick, convinced me to apply and to go there. So that's what I did. I did really well.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to school, it was quite interesting. I found it tough financially because I was a truck driver making good money, and all of a sudden I'm living on $1,000 a month instead of four.
Yeah.
But I got used to it, and then I drove taxi part-time.
Uh-huh.
I always had my work done. My assignments were always done. So on evenings and weekends, I used to drive a taxi for a local family friend that I knew in LaRange. And that brought me extra money. So that, I was happy with that. And then the initial thought was I was going to go into journalism.
Oh, yeah.
And then some old lawyer said, well, if you want to be a good journalist, get a law degree. And then, well, that's where that ended up. And I applied for law school and ended up going to Winnipeg at the University of Manitoba.
Law school.
1992.
So those were your Winnipeg years?
My Winnipeg years, 92, 93. And then I took 2 years off because I got divorced. Well, separated anyway, not divorced yet, but separated. And I started partying too much in my second year of law school, so I failed.
Uh-huh.
I failed tax law. So I took 2 years off, moved back to Beauval with friends.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And that's where I met my current spouse, my partner.
Uh-huh.
And then in 95, I went back. 96, I went back and took it as a, not necessarily part-time, but I took a couple of less classes because I was a mature student. I was 40-some years old.
Yeah.
And having never finished high school, I mean, the learning curve was a little steep, so.
Yeah.
But I did graduate in 99. And
nice.
After winging it, I guess it was, I mean, something else to achieve after having been a grade 9 dropout, right? I mean, I did get my GED in 76 in LaRange, the GED grade 12, but to actually finish high school, I never did get that opportunity. So when I started university, the learning curve was pretty steep because I had to learn how to write, you know.
Yeah.
And you got a 30-page paper to do.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing. You'll never see my first paper. I
think I would say the same thing about mine.
Oh. I read it about 3 years later, and I was embarrassed. I actually handed it in, and I actually had a decent mark. But you learn stuff, eh?
Yes, you do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's amazing to go back that far and read things that you've written in the past. It's just like you just think about how much you've changed as a person since then.
Yeah, so with law there, when I was done, I went back and worked in LaRange as an instructor, faculty member for NORTEP, NORPAC, where I had gone to school. Running computers and teaching some law-related classes. And then in 2002, I went and articled with Merchant Law Group and lasted 6 months. I couldn't, not that I couldn't practice law, I just, I don't know, my heart was not in it. Something happened there with my, I seen too much. You know, to me, it was all about money. It really turned me off.
Right.
I'm a very compassionate person.
Mm-hmm.
I like helping people. I opened residential school files, which I've never, ever been paid. I mean, merchants received millions from residential schools. I never got a cent.
Yeah.
Anyway, besides that, I just couldn't do it. There was just too much money.
Yeah.
It was all money-based, money. And Yorkton, to me, was very racist.
Yeah.
I was very visibly Aboriginal with a braid, and they'd be all courteous to me inside the courtroom, and I'd meet a lawyer at the mall, and they'd bow their head and walk by me so they didn't have to look at me, you know? I mean, I didn't like it, so I quit.
Right. And
I'll leave it at that.
Yeah. And earlier you spoke about your first wife. Tell me about your time and life with her.
Well, not really. I don't really want to talk about it. I never got to raise my kids. My twins were born a week after I started law school.
Mm-hmm.
They lived with me a year in Winnipeg, and everything was good. I really enjoyed raising them, helping them at night when Val was sleeping. I would be looking after the babies and stuff.
Yeah.
And then we came home back to Saskatchewan the following summer for school break.
Uh-huh.
And the following year, in year two, she said, no, I'm not moving to Winnipeg. I'm staying here.
Uh-huh.
After that, I really never had an opportunity to raise my kids. We used to keep them a week at a time up north when I was done. When they were small, so we spent time fishing, hunting, doing outdoor stuff with them.
Mm-hmm.
And then when things didn't go right with the ex-wife, I wouldn't get to see them. So,
when did you reconnect?
What?
When did you reconnect with them?
Well, I've always connected with them. I mean, I've always had some kind of contact, but sometimes I wouldn't see them for a year and a half.
Right.
More or less when they became adults. Well, when Megan, I guess, I haven't really connected with Cash, and he's been in and out of jail all his life.
Right.
So I haven't really had no bonding with him. I mean, he's been in and out of trouble since he was 14. He's 27 today. At least Megan's pulled out of the mess she was in. That's why I have her daughter here. She wasn't a... But now she's actually a hairdresser. She's been clean for over 3 years. She's done well.
And good.
I mean, I try and help her as much as I can, but you know, there's only so much you can do.
Yeah. And your granddaughter, how much does she know about, or how much do you think she's aware about what's going on around her?
Well, she knows. I mean, she's close to her mom.
I
mean, we're close to Megan now. I mean, without us, she wouldn't be where she is. I mean, we've helped her so many ways, financially especially, to try and get through this stuff. I mean, it's not easy to live in a city, to go to school. And then we also had her son here,
who's
5 years older than Alicia. And he's with us now during this episode with this epidemic. He's going to spend the time with us here.
Okay.
He's safer here than in Regina.
Yeah.
But my daughter's done well now. I mean, I'm so proud of her. But at the same time, I'm always worried too, because, I mean, an addiction is an addiction. It's a lifelong battle.
I know that myself.
I've had my addictions ever since coming out of the 70s, I guess. with marijuana, smoking weed. I still smoke it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's helped me in many ways as opposed to alcohol. I don't think alcohol would have done me as much as what cannabis has done. I mean, I've got a lot of friends I've lost because of alcohol.
Yeah.
Either through sickness or accidents or whatever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, of the two evils, I even tell my kids, you know, you should have started smoking weed before you started drinking when you were 12 years old in the city, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't drink until I was 18.
Mm-hmm. And your son, when's the last time you saw him?
Oh. I went to visit him in prison 2 years ago. And I finally told him, I'm not going to do this anymore. I said, I don't like going into a prison, even as a lawyer to see a client. I didn't like it.
Uh-huh.
I said, I really don't like coming here. I'm pretty rough in many ways. I'm not a, you know what I mean? I sometimes I have to tell him what's a fact. I mean,
yeah.
You're 27 years old. You haven't done anything but get in trouble. You make promises. We spend money on you on phone calls and whatnot. It comes out. A week later, he's back in. So, I mean, grow up.
Yeah, and why do you think he's going through all that? What kind of drove him to that place?
Well, you know what? Some people are just bad people.
Yeah.
He was raised up in a good home. He was never hungry. He never needed anything. My ex-wife bought him everything that he needed,
mm-hmm.
but he was the alpha male in that house.
Right.
He ran over, you know, roughshod over his mom, abused her physically, mentally, chased away any men that she might have had an interest in, and he's a domineering, I don't know how to put it, some people
yeah.
are just not nice. And
yeah.
unfortunately, I think he's one of those, because you'd think he would have grown out of it already. Yeah, I'm just, you know, I'm fed up.
Yeah.
I never grew up that way. I've never spent a night in a drunk tank. I've never gone around beating up people. So, to me, I don't know what happened to him.
Maybe he's just really angry.
Well, being angry at people doesn't solve beating them up either. So,
yeah.
No, he just makes me angry. So I don't even want to talk about him. Thank you.
Okay, so let's move on then to Debbie. When did you meet her?
I met Debbie up in Beauval. Well, I actually knew who she was years ago because her ex-husband was a conservation officer who I worked with.
Oh yeah.
So I knew of her way back when, and then I met her when I took time off school and went to Beauval to live there and work out of Beauval.
Mm-hmm.
And we became friends, and we started going out 25 years ago.
Wow, 25 years, nice.
Yeah, very nice lady, very giving, very caring person. My grandkids just love her.
Right.
Very caring person, and she taught up north for 33 years, excellent school teachers.
Mm-hmm.
Everywhere we travel, when we meet people, I mean, she was in Beauval long enough to have taught almost three generations.
Wow.
And the parents, and then now their kids and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of those people still will meet him somewhere. It's, oh, my favorite school teacher.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so yeah. nice.
Yeah, she's a very good person. I was very lucky to meet her.
Yeah. I'm sure that she's been a big support to you over all these years.
She has helped me in so many ways, especially during my down times, when things got rough.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Because I still have my demons that I've, you know, from like this residential school stuff. There's stuff that deep down still affect me, and in many ways I'll almost going through a depression, I guess, and don't even want to talk to people. And
yeah.
That's no, they're supposed to be working. So, you know, I mean, I've lost jobs not fired, but I mean, I've actually even quit jobs because of the way things, I don't know, it's just weird, but shit happens.
Yeah. So true.
Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of good jobs. I mean, I've done really well with all the jobs I've done as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if it's my personality. I get bored with something. I need mm-hmm. to do something else.
Mm-hmm.
That's what so I what do you... with prepping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was going to say, so what are your interests now?
Well, I'm trying to learn my violin.
Uh-huh.
Being close to my grandkids, we do a lot of stuff together with my grandkids. We go golfing.
Oh, fun.
I'm traveled with her most of the winter, taking her to hockey games and stuff like that. So I'm really busy, keeping busy with my grandkids.
Uh-huh.
And then around here, well, I'm trying to learn play violin.
Uh-huh.
I'm a newhound, and I'm a procrastinator, and yet I've been trying to write a book, but I don't know what to do. Maybe I'll have to get you to help me.
I think you have a lot of stories for a book.
I've got a lot of stories, yes. I've written some, and then I lost them. And then I've got stories, and I've got a Mac museum. I'm an Apple person.
Oh, yeah.
I have my original 1989 Macintosh Apple that I used for printing news magazines. Because, yeah, that's right. Before I went back to school, I took desktop publishing in Saskatoon in 1989. That's when Macs came out.
Right.
And I learned how to make news magazines and stuff like that, publishing.
Neat.
I ended up with a 90-some average.
Having you were always a good student, hey?
Yeah. So anyway, and then that's what made me go to think of university after that, was that I forget how many months it was, that desktop publishing course. I actually have a certificate on it. And then I did publishing. I worked in Meadow Lake for a while with Northwest Eagle with First Nations, and then I used to help Jill Gracie out of LaRange with the Northerner. That was my job placement when I actually was in NORPAC.
Okay.
And then me and Debbie ran our own little news magazine out of Ovalder for a while when I was out of school. My time school was off. So, and then when I was at NORPAC, I made publications there and stuff. So, but other than that, I've always loved learning.
Yeah. Do you still do as much reading as you used to?
Oh, yeah, but it's mostly news right now.
Yeah, it's hard to get away from the news right now, hey?
Yes, it's a lot of stuff happening out there.
Mm-hmm. Are you worried about it for your family?
Yes, I am. For my mom, too. She's 90-some years old.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what else do you want to know?
Well, I'm thinking that maybe this is actually a pretty good place to end things, but I do have one last question.
Okay.
And I guess I would just say, you know, what kind of, I'm not even sure how to ask this, but it's, you know, given what you experienced in your own life and subsequently what was experienced in your children's lives, what would you hope for the future, but also what would you say to other school kids out there right now learning about this story, and what is it that you really want them to remember and to retain in all of this?
To never give up, no matter how hard life is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my education could have stopped in 69 when I got the boot from the school. I could end it up, as Samuleski told me. Mr. Samuleski came to me a year after I got kicked out of school. He caught me at Hudson's Bay store. I was selling my fur.
Okay.
I wanted to talk to you, he said. So I said, okay. He said, Mike, I'm really disappointed what happened last year. And I really believed you did it on purpose, he said. And I said, no. I said, but it had nothing to do with that. I said, it all had to do with was the abuse.
Yeah.
He said, well, I'm really sorry, said Mike, but you'll be a bum for the rest of your life.
Oh.
Well, I used those words to have done what I've done for myself.
Right.
I actually used his words to prove to myself that I would never be a bum.
Uh-huh.
And I survived this far, so.
Yeah, you never were.
No.
No, and look at all that you've done.
Life was rough in many ways. But after I was done with trapping, I went from a co-op clerk to a manager
mm-hmm.
in a flying community in Pine
mm-hmm.
House, which I had to run the store,
yeah.
the post office, the mail service, everything. And
right.
I ended up as a loans officer after that. And then after that, I was a community development worker with the Métis Nation. And then I got into trucking.
Mm-hmm.
And after trucking, I got into law. And then ever since then, either I've been involved in First Nations governance, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, of some sort, doing HR work or whatever.
Yeah.
And in a few in between there, I've done what I can. Plus, I still drive truck.
Yeah.
I've done okay. I'm not a millionaire, but I'm still alive and I'm quite healthy. That's the main thing.
And your message is to never give up. You can always be who you're going to be, right?
Never give up. You're never too old to learn. I was 36 when I went back to school, and I was 4 to 5 when I graduated from law school.
Wow, good for you.
It's never too late.
Yeah.
To learn.
Mm-hmm.
And to never give up. No matter how many mountains you have to climb, I've climbed mountains all my life. Climbed to the top, right to the bottom, hit Skid Row, climb back
yeah.
up.
Yeah.
Life wasn't easy a lot of times, but you got to keep going.
Yeah.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And Debbie has really helped me launch in the last, especially the last 10 years when things were up, you know, I mean, because I was starting to, I never had trouble getting work when I was young. I really realized after I was getting older, it wasn't so easy anymore.
Yeah.
Because you're worth too much money. They
yeah.
can hire people for the price of one. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And then my track record in terms of my interaction with my bosses in some places like the government wasn't good.
Yeah.
So I've always been kind of anti-government. I think that's why.
Right.
So I tried getting a job with a friend of mine who was an Aboriginal judge, and the province wouldn't hire me because of my political views.
Right.
I wasn't conservative enough.
Right.
Yeah. Other than that, life keeps going.
Yeah. Well, I want to just take a moment and say thank you so much for sharing your story and being such an amazing interviewee. You've had so many incredible adventures in your life, and I just want to thank you for sharing it with both me and with other school kids out there who
yeah.
really want to hear this message from you, you know, and want to understand what happened, because I think it's not really entirely clear to Canadians what has happened.
Yeah, and in terms of my Métis site,
yeah,
if you go on there, if you go to Sandy Point,
yeah.
at the bottom of that Sandy Point page, it'll say a map of Sandy Point. I actually drew a map, and you'll see where all our houses were, where our first little log home was, our second home, my grandpa's house, the gardener's side. It's all there. You can use that if you want.
Fantastic.
And then there's another map. I think it's in my main page. It'll say satellite maps.
Okay.
It'll have a map of Isla La Crosse Lake with a whole bunch of numbers on it where all these people, different people lived.
Okay, perfect.
Yep.
And also, I think probably your artwork, we're going to access that for the
yeah,
lesson
it's all
plan.
There.
Fantastic.
Yep, it's all there.
Thanks again, Mike, and I want to wish you a wonderful week.
Yeah, thank you very much. I look forward to hearing from you again.
You will soon. Thanks so much again. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.